Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope that you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have... Hello, thank you for tuning in. You are listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit biteradio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my guest is Dr. Amy Sarin, and we will be talking about her new book, The Stress Switch, The Truth About Stress and How to Short Circuit It. In her debut book, internationally renowned neuropsychologist Dr. Amy Sarin sets the record straight about stress. New neuroscience shows the mechanisms behind the stress switch and how it can be deactivated in ways you haven't been told. Dr. Sarin is a world-renowned neuropsychologist on a mission to teach you how to turn down the stress switch using new methods based on neuroscience. As a neuropsychologist and stress expert, she understands the complexity of brain-based issues that utilizes cutting-edge integrative approaches to help people reach their own individual goals. She is co-creator of Touchpoints Wearable Devices, and it is a winner of the coveted Digital Trends and Forbes Top Tech of CES 2019 Award. You can find out more by visiting her website, which is amysarin.com, and that's amysarin.com. And with that, I'd like to welcome Dr. Sarin to the show. Good day. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's my pleasure. And boy, is this a topic that I think everyone can relate to. So I'm looking forward to today's show.
Yeah, I love this because this is something that I think relates to everybody. Everybody has questions about it. We've been told some, you know, not so great things about how to try to control stress or that we can't control it. And so I really love that I've discovered some things that are quite new that can help a lot of people. So thanks again for having me.
My pleasure. As inspiration is my passion, what inspired you to write The Stress Switch?
Well, you know, I've been a neuropsychologist for about 12 years. And several years ago, I was a little bit frustrated with the status quo of just doing talk therapy with people and kind of our obsession with chemicals and consciousness. And I started looking to treatments that were a little more cutting edge, but still mainstream. And I found that if you use what we call a bottom-up approach to treating stress, it was much more effective. And so in isolating a variable that we were only using in doctor's offices and allowing people to use it anytime to reduce their stress, I realized that this was, this light bulb went on and I thought, okay, the whole world really needs to know about this. And then throughout the years of developing this technology and seeing people using it and what it could do, I actually had to retrain myself on the neuroscience of stress because I realized that most of us, doctors included, actually have it wrong. We're really overcomplicating what stress is. And if we understand it in a very simple way, and we treat it in a very simple way, then people's lives can improve by leaps and bounds. And so I made it my mission to get the word out in another way that people could access.
That's great. Yeah, because a book, you can reach so many more people than that individual or even, a group in kind of a classroom kind of setting. So would you mind sharing with the listeners? I mean, we all have stress and we all know it kind of affects us in various ways, but can you maybe go into a little bit of detail as to, you know, what stress really does to an individual?
Yeah. And, you know, I think we've all seen the, oh no, stress raises cortisol. It leads to belly fat, blah, blah, blah. I mean, we all kind of have this vague sense of what it does to us. We know when we go to the doctor and we have some kind of a condition, they go, well, keep your stress down, you know, and this and that. But I think where the breakdown is that number one, people think that stress is something outside of themselves that then happens to them. And stress is actually the moment-to-moment fluctuation of your nervous system's reaction to a trigger. And I think what people don't realize is the trigger doesn't have to be your mother-in-law standing in front of you or somebody yelling at you or, you know, almost getting in a car accident. The trigger is anything sensory. Okay, it can be a loud sound. It can be too much background noise. It can be an uncomfortable physical sensation from sitting too long. All these things are senses actually kind of are getting fed into a network in our brain, and that network is deciding what to do with our stress switch. And the important thing is here, it does it without your awareness. We are terrible at knowing how stressed out we are. So when we ask people in the lab, you know, how stressed out are you and this and that, they'll say certain things, but then oftentimes they're off. And it's because your biology, your nervous system is your stress system. And so when we realize that it's as simple as some kind of sensory trigger or a thought triggers your stress switch, it's much easier trigger to go up than it is to go down with a thought. This is why consciousness fails us, right? You're sitting there, you're feeling stressed out, going, oh my gosh, I don't need to be stressed. I know logically this isn't a big deal, but your heart's racing and it's pounding. That doesn't work to bring your stress switch down, okay? So that principle of a thought can turn it on very easily, but it doesn't turn it off very easily. That's very, very important. And once we understand how the stress switch works in the body and that hacking into it doesn't require thinking or conscious action on your part, then we start to be in business. And people go, oh, I could have had a V8, you know, and then they stop beating themselves. They stop beating themselves up for all these times that they tried to de-stress themselves and failed. And there's a basic misunderstanding about how this works. And this is brand new neuroscience. You know, we've been taught, even my graduate school, left brain versus right brain, you know, conscious that, you know, first you see a snake, then you recognize it's a snake consciously, and then you go into fight or flight. And the opposite is true. You go into fight or flight before you realize what's happening. That's the whole point of this fast, low-road system. But this is the system that's in control of your stress, not your consciousness.
Yeah. So, well, one of the things, you know, when you said that sometimes, you know, people may not recognize their stress level, and the idea of it being a stress switch. Do you feel that sometimes people switch or forget to turn the switch off, so that if it's on constant on, then that can really hamper their perception of their stress level?
That is absolutely true. So if we think of the switch as like a dimmer, there's a default setting that most of us, you know, we wake up with. Some people wake up and they're a one or two, they're pretty laid back. Some people wake up and the thoughts start happening. I got to do this. I forgot to do that. What about this? What about that? And they're sort of in this constant state of low or medium grade stress. And when you think of that dimmer switch going up, the higher your stress switch goes up, there's another switch next to it. And think of that as your conscious control and your executive function. Can you plan and organize? Can you think through things? Can you even experience joy and happiness and things like that? And there's a direct, when the stress switch gets turned up, proportionally, the other dimmer switch goes down so that you don't have access to rational thinking, logical thought. You know, people get scatterbrained, they get irritated. The whole point of stress is to start shutting down things that we don't need for survival. And because we're biological organisms, you know, our nervous systems are like, okay, well, you don't need to be able to plan what you're going to say in that meeting when you're in survival mode. So I'm not going to allow you to access those thoughts. Or you don't need long-term memory, which is why, you know, if you're stressed out taking a test, you bomb it if you're too stressed out. So those are the things that I've included in my book to really say, you know, we're thinking about this raw. We're just sort of thinking like, oh, life is stressful. Life doesn't have to be stressful. Your reaction to triggers are stressful, and we can change your baseline reaction and we can make certain things not triggers, but we have to systematically work at that Otherwise, we're kind of living in a state of chronic stress as a society and as individuals, and it's ruining us.
Yeah. Okay, now, if a listener feels already stressed and they feel that they don't have time to add something else, like reading your book, how much time is, first of all, how could your book help them? And then how much time is needed to be invested, at least to begin learning about switching off stress?
So I think the book can be helpful because it's really breaks down why the thinking about stress is wrong and gives some concrete things to do to lower the stress switch. And my aim is not to add 2 hours to people's day. You know, you get these books and everything and they're like, okay, you just have to do this list of 50 things every day and then you'll have a better life. And it's like, well, hold on.
really?
That stresses me out, right? I can't add 2 hours to my day. So what do I do that's easy, right? And so, you know, there's simple things that you can do that really, I don't want to add to your day. You already probably have too much to your day and your brain is kicking off all these have-tos, which aren't really have-tos, right? So the biggest thing that you can do, and it's a little cliche, but again, it doesn't take more time, is regulate your sleep patterns. So if you're not getting the recommended 7 to 9 hours of sleep at night, start doing that. And it's not going to take away more from your day because I guarantee you that most of us are wasting time before we go to bed at night looking at artificial light. And I'm not so concerned with your screens as I am. Just the overhead lighting will jack up your circadian rhythms. So people can buy really inexpensive orange glasses on Amazon. Honeywell makes UVX glasses. They're like $8 or $10. There's Swanee's. There's Dr. Michael Bruce, the famous sleep doctor, has his own brand of orange glasses. If you put those on a couple hours before you go to bed at night, that's going to help regulate your melatonin, your circadian rhythm. And then if you try to go to bed about the same time every night and get about 7 to 9 hours of sleep, that alone has shown to decrease not only anxiety, but also depression significantly in a 3-week trial. So spending $8, $10, $50, and then creating a new habit takes very little effort that will pay off huge, right? So that's one thing. Another thing you can do is get the technology that's embedded in the touch points. And there's information on that on my website at amysarin.com. Now, there is a cost to those. They're about $160 online. So it's about the same cost as a therapy session. But when you use the technology, what happens is it interferes with the sensory network in the brain. It's called the salience network. And it makes a different decision about your stress. So in science, peer-reviewed, published study, we showed that it reduces stress by 62% in 30 seconds. And that's without you doing anything else other than pushing 3 buttons and turning them on. So that, I think, is the number one hack. And there's also a study that just got published in Brazil, Brazilian athletes, and it was double-blind and placebo-controlled and, you know, all that. So the gold standard kind of research that showed it lowered cortisol and brought cortisol back to stability after they had to do a mental math in front of someone. So I think we can all, you know, imagine having to stand up in front of a panel of academic judges at a research institution and they give you math problems and you have to answer them. That pretty much stresses everyone out, right? And so measuring their cortisol in different times showed that when you had the technology, they just had their technology on their wrist. Or you could put it in your pockets or your socks, as long as one's on one side and one's on the other side of your body. Just having this on actually statistically changed the cortisol, which we know is a stress hormone in the body. So we know that when we're stabilizing cortisol, people are less stressed out. And so doing nothing else but having this technology on you and it's non-invasive actually has a profound effect. And it's because of that very principle I shared in the beginning, that stress is your body's automatic reaction to sensory information. And when we change sensory information in this particular way, we can get a huge impact on stress right away. And you can do that with music, right? If you listen to soothing music and you get in a hot bath and you do all of that, that's the same thing. You're actually adding sensory information to lower your stress. But that takes a long time and it requires you to leave what you're doing. I cannot simultaneously do that and be sending emails at work. So we need this hack as we go about our day, and it doesn't really add anything, that 2 hours of, you know, prescriptive stuff that then quite honestly we don't keep up on, and then we feel bad that we there was something else we were supposed to be doing that we weren't. So this is a different solution.
Yeah. So would wearing that technology help those who have learned stress responses? I use that snake example. I mean, I'm not a fan of snakes at all, you know, and I probably have that. So would having that on help maybe reduce the conditioned, or I wouldn't say conditioned response, but that a response, that stimulus response that would be, you know, that I maybe, you know, existed for a long time?
Yeah. So the answer is it depends. In the snake example, you actually want to go in fight or flight when you see a snake.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So it's not going to make you not go into fight or flight. But let's say you have them on and you're at your desk, you know, hopefully nobody gets snakes in their office, right? But and then all of a sudden a snake comes in. You want to go into fight or flight. And if you have the touch points on, you will go into fight or flight, but you will actually come back to a more stable space place faster. Now, in the case of things that you're not biologically pre-programmed, by the way, even if you didn't really know what a snake was, we actually have kind of in our DNA certain things that are supposed to set off our fight or flight every single time reliably. And so like really loud sounds, immediate sounds will do it. Seeing a snake will do it, and that won't go away. But for things that are not biologically wired, so let's say someone has a fear of flying, okay? And their nervous system is going into fight or flight, sometimes just thinking about flying, or if they're about to get on a plane, or if they're planning a trip and they know they have to get on a plane, then you actually, if you apply the touch points, it seems to accelerate what we call the desensitization effect. And this is always how we've cured phobias in psychology, is we have a way of desensitizing people to things. And what that is basically we expose you to either a thought about something or the actual scenario, and then we make it so your nervous system cannot respond the same way. And so we're systematically toning down the stress switch in those situations. And then over time, because your memory networks dictate what happens the next time. So our brain works off heuristics. So this means that if I'm in a situation and I'm only at, my stress switch is a 3, the next time I'm in a situation, my default is going to be a 3. But if I'm in that same situation, it's a 7. The next time I think about the situation or I'm in it again, it's a 7 unless I disrupt that pattern. So the technology will disrupt the pattern, called a pattern interrupt, and then it changes the default setting on the stress switch for that particular thing. So now when I have patients who want to get rid of an airplane phobia, sometimes I can just have them do it with the technology outside of the office, and they don't actually even have to come in to see me for therapy, maybe like one session. Instead of it used to take 12 to 24 sessions. And then even if somebody's really anxious, then it would sometimes take a lot longer than that just for one phobia. But we know now that the quicker we can desensitize and to a larger extent, then we can, you know, phobias are absolutely 100% curable. Like there's no reason why people should be walking around with phobias right now with our modern science, by the way. And yet one of the problems I talk about in my book is that people are really limited in their thinking of what's possible, you know, and it reminds me of the 4-minute mile. Sir Roger Bannister, you know, a neurologist, ran a 4-minute mile because he was like, well, this can be done, you know, and no one else thought it could. And he just did interval training on his breaks while he was working on his medical degree and ran a 4-minute mile. And then as soon as he did, what happened? All these other people ran 4-minute miles, and now it's everybody knows it's doable. Well, we are pre-4-minute mile right now in terms of understanding what these hacks can do for your nervous system. And I think once people start to understand it, then it's just going to become ubiquitous. And people are going, oh, of course we can lower our stress by 62% in 30 seconds without stopping doing what you're doing. Of course, like that's just our new normal, you know, and that's kind of my dream because we really don't need PTSD either. You know, phobias, things like PTSD, they're preventable and they're treatable. And the research is out there. It just takes so long for people to adopt change, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's
so
it would be wonderful to lower the incidence and help people to live more fully, to get rid of that.
Of course. Yeah, because really what we're talking about here, and this is, you know, really your platform, is the emergence of joy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Joy cannot emerge when your stress switch is above a 2 or a 3. It just can't. It's blocked. So
yeah,
my job is to help people lower their stress so that they remember that they're kind, first of all, and that they can access joy.
Wonderful. I like that. Now, we talked about how stress impacts the individual. Now, how about how an individual's stress affecting their family or others are around them in their immediate circle?
Yeah, it's such a beautiful thing. You know, the first title of my book was actually The United States of Stress, instead of The Stress Switch. And it was a metaphor for, you know, we are all connected. And our connection, by the way, is not some very ethereal cuckoo idea. I mean, we can measure this. We can add someone in a room who's actually stressed out without them saying anything, people's nervous systems start to respond to that, whether or not they want to. And so this is, you know, we have a mirror neuron network in our brain that responds to the feelings and the actions of others, whether or not we like it and want to, right? And so because we're connected in this way as human beings, we not only owe it to ourselves to stress less, but it will affect the people around you in profound ways. And so stress actually spreads. You know, we have a president right now, regardless of your, you know, political affiliation or your like or dislike of him, that doesn't matter. But I think we can all agree that he operates quite a bit out of fight or flight. And the polls will show that Americans are incredibly stressed out, and the world is actually incredibly stressed out because there's this leader in the spotlight that's operating out of fight or flight, and it triggers all of our fight or flight. If there's a level of uncertainty, what's he going to do next? We're all on kind of pins and needles when we're thinking about it or exposed to it, because that's how connected we are. And so it really affects everyone around you if you're stressed out. And so it's been doing, you know, I like the Headspace app for meditation and I use it. And one of the things that are in a lot of meditations is, you know, think about how you being calm and focused and these things, you know, affect all the people around you. And that's part of one of the meditations, right? Because we are not isolated. We're not really, none of us are islands, right? And so if we want to be better for other people, we need to be better for ourselves. And we cannot willfully do that with our consciousness, because as I've hopefully demonstrated, consciousness is really not the key to lowering your stress switch in real time. You know, so I meet yogis with panic disorder. And the Dalai Lama was in the U.S. a while ago and, you know, at a conference and asked neuropsychologists, you know, he's like, hey, by the way, if you have anything that can make me not have to meditate so much, I'd love to hear what it is. I really don't want to spend all this time meditating, you know. And so meditation is great to provide a base of healthy behaviors and a mind that is not so reactive as a default. But it doesn't undo the effect of things that happen. So I say, you know, it's like having an electric car and certain things will recharge your batteries, but they won't fix the cracked windshield. And we kind of want to look at the whole system.
Yeah. Well, you know, I can see where the idea of the initial in the United States of stress would have, I mean, the United aspect and the state of stress would have, you know, would have fit, but I agree. Stress switch is so much, the visual is so much better and concise and really gets people to thinking that there is a switch, you know, that can be utilized.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. I think that's the main principle, right? We all kind of know stress is bad and all this kind of stuff. And I really wanted to make it concrete for people that this is a switch that can be turned on and off very quickly. And and I think it's interesting that veterinarians really understand this. So when I talk to veterinarians about the technology, because it does work on animals, they go, oh, yeah, of course it works. But then when I talk to psychologists, they get really confused. And the reason why is because they're obsessed with consciousness. And the vets are like, oh, yeah, we're dealing with a dog brain or a horse brain or whatever. And they are more into the nervous system, understanding the nervous system and understanding all of those things. And they're not clouded by this concept of conscious thinking, and they're not and control, right? Mm-hmm. So this is a distraction for us.
How funny. Yeah, I mean, you know, it sometimes it can get to be much more complicated than it needs to be, and after all, we are animals by our nature. So so now we talked about how it can affect you know, families or individuals around us. Can the stress switch help kids or adolescents?
Absolutely. You can use I don't know how parents, I'm a mom, I have two kids, 10 and 12. I don't know how some parents survive without this. So in kids, you know, they go through a lot of times where they're reacting to things, and there's these things that build up, you know, like if I have a 70-year-old in my office and he's got some core trauma that he's working out, it's usually when he was six years old and getting bullied. That got embedded, you know, in his nervous system, let's say, there was never a pattern interrupt to get out of that. And it unconsciously affected him his entire life, right? But let's say I had that 70-year-old when he was six and I had the touch points and he comes home and he got bullied that day from school. I just have him hold those while he cries and talks to me about it. And then I have just desensitized him to that, and then it doesn't get embedded in the same way. So we can, with kids, we have a profound ability to nip that in the bud. And my hope in creating the technology was to get them into foster children's hands, because they're the ones who have so much trauma that their nervous systems are in a constant state of reactivity. And if we can lower that reactivity, then they won't have a lot of the poor outcomes that they do just because of that, you know, and we see that over time in these kids as they develop. And the other thing is, in kids with developmental disabilities, there was a study done on the technology in the UK that showed that versus a control group, the technology reduced 72% of self-disruptive and self-harming behaviors. So, like, they had one student with autism who would bang his head. He banged his head about 280 times in 1 week in the classroom, just as part of his normal behavior. And then with the control devices on. And then when they activated the technology the next week, he actually banged his head 18 times in a week with no other intervention. And that makes sense, because when in people who are on the autism spectrum, and they what happens is their nervous systems react to very subtle sensory information. So if someone turns the light on, their nervous system might react to that as though they were seeing a snake. It's a faulty system, faulty wiring, so to speak. And if we're using the tech for stress, it seems to have a profound impact on children with some of these developmental disabilities and problems. And so that can be a real lifesaver for kids with specific difficulties. And kids with ADHD and anxiety also have found kind of an increase in their ability to focus, because, you know, you can't focus when you're stressed out. And if stress is exacerbating a lack of focus, it makes sense that applying this technology would help to increase that in the short term. So it's not going to cure, you know, ADHD or anything like that, but it certainly could be kind of part of a complete breakfast in terms of helping these kids. And I have used it. So there's so many examples in my book and also just in my life where, you know, I'm using them on my kids. I mean, just yesterday, my kids had to go meet their teachers and something happened. And so I popped them in my 10-year-old's pockets, and then he calmed down immediately, and it didn't turn into an hour issue and tantrum and, you know, difficulty that we kind of talk through and work through until they're reasonably calm. But then it embeds itself in the nervous system as something awful. so we're constantly nipping these things in the bud. And I think it creates a profound change. And, you know, that was my hope, is I can't see the whole world in my office. But I would like to expand what I've learned to help people beyond the people that could ever meet me in this lifetime, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, I'm glad that, you know, in addition to the ADHD and the autism spectrum, I'm glad you mentioned the foster children. I had a woman on my show, Shenandoah Cephalo. She wrote a book called Garbage Bag Suitcase, you know, and it was, you know, the idea that foster children, basically, you know, their suitcase going from home to home is a garbage bag. And in her memoir, she just, I mean, it was so poignant and talking about her experience and the stresses involved. And, you know, and I think that stress contributes to the challenges of being a placement, as well as, you know, the constant shifting, you know, so that, you know, getting that out there to that population would really be helpful.
I think people, again, overcomplicate things, and, you know, these kids, they almost all look ADHD. Well, you know what? Guess what? We all look ADHD when we're really stressed out. We're reactive mess because we're in fight or flight. And these kids' nervous systems are very often in fight, flight, or freeze mode. And they don't have control over that. And so, you know, the kid that stands there and freezes, and their new foster parent's like, what do you want for dinner? Or go pick up your socks, and they're just standing there. And then they're like, okay, they go in, they get diagnosed with oppositional defiant disorder, or they look ADHD because they can't focus in school. You know, these kids are traumatized, and their nervous systems are not able to regulate to the point where their higher order thinking can shut on. It's about the stress switch. When their baseline stress switch is too high, they cannot function normally. And then we talk to them about choices, and we get them in therapy one time a week, and then we, you know, have them talk to caseworkers, and it's just not effective in a lot of cases. And we have to get their stress switch, baseline stress switch, into a reasonable range before the good stuff starts to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're about halfway through the show, Dr. Sarin, so I want to take just a quick 90-second break. And I do want to invite listeners, if you would like to call in and ask any questions, you can call in at 619-789-4359. And for those listening live in the chat room, if you have any questions you would like for me to pose, feel free to type them in. And then when we come back, Dr. Sarin, as a neuropsychologist, you obviously see a lot of people in therapy. So when we come back, maybe you can share with us, what are some of the most common stress issues that you see come up during those sessions? Okay?
Okay, great.
Okay, great. Everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back after this brief break. Hello, this is Robert Sharp. I want to thank you for joining us and hope that you are enjoying today's show. Just a reminder that we have a wealth of information and resources available on our website, BiteRadio.me. There is a calendar of upcoming shows, along with an archive link that will give you access to more than 1,400 shows we have had over the past 9 years. Also on the site is a link to the products and services we provide: books, photography, a wellness store, and self-publishing assistance. Our show is a free podcast on iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, iHeartRadio, and TuneIn. And you can subscribe for free on any of those platforms by using the links on our website homepage. We are on many social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, etc. And we also have buttons to those platforms at the top of our homepage. Our website, BiteRadio.me, has much for you to explore and enjoy. I also very much appreciate you supporting our guests, and especially today's guest. And now, back to the show. Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us again today. My very special guest is Dr. Amy Sarin, and we've been talking about her new book, The Stress Switch, The Truth About Stress and How to Short Circuit It. And again, you can find out more by visiting her website, which is amysarin.com, and that's A-M-Y serin.com. And if you're feeling stressed, start by de-stressing and pick up a copy. So we're back. Dr. Serin, thanks for staying with me.
Of course.
Okay. So people come to you in therapy. So what are some of the most common stress issues that you see people having?
I think there are physical symptoms of stress and then the emotional symptoms of stress. So the most common in children is headaches, stomach aches, and sleep problems. And so oftentimes when kids come in, you know, parents bring their kids in, they don't even talk to me about the stomach ache. They just are having other issues. And I'm like, well, wait, your child's having a stomach ache, you know, three times a week at school. This is stress, and I can actually probably fix it. And they look at me like I'm crazy because they have a GI appointment and they're going to get their kids scoped and all these things. But it's not, there's no mind-body separation here. And stress modulates. In other words, stress affects, you know, most physical disease. So if someone has, people with cold sores know this, you know, they've got this virus laying dormant, and if they get really stressed out, their body is in a state of compromise, and then the cold sore comes out, right? And then it goes back and goes dormant when they're not stressed out. So it's very, very important that we really pay attention to our stress switches and where they are and know the physical symptoms. So headaches, stomach aches, and then sleeplessness. And sometimes also heart racing, and in cases of panic, people going to the ER thinking they're having a heart attack, and really it's just a panic attack, but it does feel like they're dying. And then the emotional toll that stress takes and can be very come out in people's behaviors. People who are very angry, you know, anger only occurs in when your stress switch is high. It's part of the same system, and also you know, people being irritable, lashing out at people, you know, and feeling also emotionally very drained. You know, some people think their lives are very busy and very difficult, but when you actually look at what they're doing on a daily basis, someone else may not be overwhelmed. And again, the modulating factor there is stress. So people feeling chronically overwhelmed, or, you know, laying in bed at night and not being able to go to sleep because they can't turn their monkey mind off. All of those are the most common symptoms. And then in more rare cases, we get people who are worried all the time, panicking, have phobias, and really kind of lose their function. They can't leave their homes and things like that. And those are the more extreme examples of people whose stress switches are maybe at a default 6, 7, or 8 every day versus most of us, which is usually a 3 or 4. But here's the interesting thing. Our research of 1,109 people shows that the average person, just with one thought, their stress switch will spike to over 7.5 out of 10. So if I say, hey, think of something stressful, and now tell me how that, you know, how stressful that feels on a scale of 0 to 10, the average is 7.5 with one thought. And that's very interesting. The only group of people that do not go up to an average of a 7.5 are people who are habitual meditators. Or people who are under the influence of some kind of a drug at that time. You know, like a lot of people, the medical marijuana is a new thing, and they don't get stressed. Now, I don't recommend that because there's other consequences. Whenever we invade the body with a chemical, we are looking at a different set of side effects and consequences. Right. So I'm always looking for non-invasive things. But habitual meditators, oftentimes I cannot get them above a 3.
Wow.
Not that I'm trying to, you know, get really stressed out. And I tell people, hey, think about it, but don't worry, I'm going to take it away. But the average drop from a 7.5 is to about 2.8 in 30 seconds. So I can get the average person a 7.5 down to about a 2.8 in 30 seconds with the technology. So I'm essentially, we're hacking into that system just with just holding these vibrating devices. And then their brain suddenly looks like the meditator's brain in that moment. And not only that, but the thing they were thinking about then never quite feels as stressful again because the memory networks take over the next time they think about it.
Wow. You know, I mean, it's amazing when you you think about the body's reactions to thought, you know, to the thought of a stressful situation, you know, raising it so high, and then also the meditative thought process in lowering that. So, I mean, to me, it's, you know, when people, you know, the idea of be careful what you think, you know, as well as what you say, it seems so right on.
Yeah. Well, it is right on. And here's the interesting thing. We can use, so when I go to meditators and go think of something stressful, and let's say we can get them up to like a 5 or a 6, I go, now bring it down. They actually can manipulate their stress switch more with conscious thinking because they're practiced at it, and there's more neural connections in this top-down process of being able to control the autonomic system. You know, in extreme cases, you know, Buddhist monks can raise their core body temperature, right? Wow, what a cool thing to be able to control your body that much because of these years of practice of strengthening this top-down system. It's basically taking a very weak system, your consciousness, to control a very strong system, your autonomic nervous system, and then strengthening your consciousness so much that it has more power. But that takes so much time and effort that most of us don't have the ability to do that. And even the yogis don't have the ability to do that in extreme situations. So we still need the bottom-up process to help us out. Because most of us, let's face it, are not going to just go to Tibet for 7 years and meditate 8 hours a day. If you can, that's great, do it. But most of us, that's not really going to happen, myself included. So then what do we do? You know, just like most of us can't do 3 hours of yoga every morning, right?
Yeah.
So we need real world solutions. And this is the best one that I found that, again, doesn't disrupt, because even the meditators, you say, hey, okay, we got you up to a 5 or 6. Good job. You know, that's as high as I can probably get you. Now bring it down. And they can bring it down to a 2 with conscious thinking. But guess what they had to do? They had to shift their thoughts. And so they had to stop what they were doing and focus and shift their thought to bring it down. With the touch points, you don't have to think about anything. It's doing it for you via the interference in this network, this preconscious salience network that's integrating sensory information. So again, you're getting the same benefit, but a different process that doesn't require you to shift what you're doing. So that's the genius in it.
Yeah, that's good. I can see, you know, the benefit of not having to have it done automatically, you know, to have it not require that. And I do see, though, the value in the meditative process and creating those brain connections that allow you, you know, to modulate, you know, the experience.
Mm-hmm.
So now one of the things that a lot of people are stressed about is finances. You know, it just seems to mm-hmm. be a very common area that really just gets people all uptight. So how can someone deal with, you know, the idea of, you know, financial stress and, you know, maybe situations don't change, you know, are they difficult to change in an immediate kind of way? So how would you suggest people cope with the stress of financial challenge?
So I think there's 2 things here. You know, one is what occurs to us mostly because we love control and, you know, consciousness and feeling like we're doing something is, well, if I just had more money, then I would feel better, right? But when we look to psychology, we find that really isn't the case. That when people have their basic needs met, if you're fighting for survival and you cannot pay your rent, then that's one level of stress. And yes, something external needs to change about that. And that will probably help. But once people achieve a certain level of financial stability, what happens is that any more than that is not going to automatically lower the stress switch. In fact, most people who are very wealthy then create this base of complication in their lives, and they actually sometimes are even more stressed out about their finances, you know? Now I have this money and I have to protect it and somebody's trying to steal this from me and should I invest in this company or that company? Or I have, you know, you look at this and you really see that the proportion of wealthy people who can more than afford, you know, most of what they want or all that they want, then create stress about what to do with the excess. So this idea that if we change how much money we have, we're automatically going to be less stressed is actually quite false. Now, that doesn't help lower your stress at all. You just need to know that. So there's two pieces to this. I mean, if you're mismanaging your money, that's great. You know, you can get better at managing it. But a lot of times we're not better at managing it if we're stressed. So one thing that came out of our research is this idea of addiction and craving and impulsive behavior. And if you have touch points on, for example, you're more likely to make a sound decision than if you don't. And so people who are going to buy something to make themselves feel better, you're trying to regulate your stress through purchasing something. And if we can lower your stress in that moment, you're going to have more impulse control and you're not going to need to regulate. And this, by the way, this goes for gambling, this goes for eating, this goes for doing whatever drug it is that you do. If you are in a state of calm, you are so much less likely to go into that impulsive behavior. So this technology can help people with impulsive spending if that's an issue, I think. But then the other issue is we can desensitize someone's stress about any particular thing. Fear of flying, fear of elevators, you know, money, I'm not good enough, you know, all these things. So why don't we desensitize that upset and that fear with the technology or with therapy if it's really bad, and then things will kind of fall into place. A lot of people say, you know what, this is interesting, my financial situation didn't change at all, but I feel better about it. And it's like, yeah, that's the same thing as you probably weren't going to crash when you got on that airplane anyway, so we didn't change anything external, we just changed your nervous system's reaction to your thinking about it. And so there's kind of a two-pronged approach. But then here's the kicker, because here's what some people will say. Well, nope, I need to keep the fear. Isn't fear good? Because it keeps me in line, right? If I'm not afraid to gain weight, then I'm just going to gorge on donuts until I gain 50 pounds, right? Or if I'm not afraid of not being able to make rent, then I won't be motivated. And you can use fear in the short term for motivation, but that means you're running on adrenaline, which will eventually, it's a junk food crappy system that is going to wear you out over time. It's not a good strategy. Mm-hmm. And what I tell people is you don't need fear. You know, I don't need fear. Like that's like saying, okay, if I'm afraid of getting arrested, I need to be afraid of getting arrested. Otherwise I'm going to punch somebody in the face and get in trouble. And right. I need to keep that fear. Otherwise I'm just going to go around punching people. I'm not going to punch people because I don't want to hurt anybody. And that has nothing to do with fear, right? You don't want to overspend because you'd rather be financially responsible and you'd rather be calm. So the fear really isn't serving you. And I have to spend a lot of time, interestingly, convincing people but their fear is not a good thing. And then we go back to the stress switch and say, look, if this is true, the higher your stress switch, the lower all these other good things about your humanity are, right? Empathy, thinking, joy, planning and organizing, you know, all these things are lower. You can just buy into that concept and trust me as a neuroscientist. Then you really need to believe that you don't have to have this fear to drive you to productive behavior. It's not productive for you. Fear is really only productive when you have to be in fight or flight. And unless you're being chased by a saber-toothed tiger, you really don't need to be in fight or flight.
Yeah. Very, very good. Yeah, because there are people who feel that fear is necessary, you know, and I mean, I'm not one. You know, but now I am going to be going to Gatlinburg, and I do have an aversion to heights, but they have a brand new skywalk that I'm going to face my fear and do that.
You just turned your stress switch up. Did you feel that?
yeah.
And your voice came, so I could hear your stress switch going up. I'm thinking about this skywalk. And so here's what I would do with you. I would say, hey, put the touch points on when you think about it, before you go. And then when you do skywalk, put them on, because then it's just going to be so much easier to confront that fear. It'll lower your stress significantly. And then it won't cause flooding, because here's what you run the risk of when you do that. Two things can happen. Number one is, you know, it's a long skywalk and you go and you get done and your nervous system calms down. You go, okay, great, that was great. And now the second time is easier, right? This is why new stuff is hard the first time. Going to a new place is always more stressful, being in a situation you haven't been in, right? Because novelty and not knowing what to expect is more stressful for us. So for you, you do that first time, and then it's easier the second time. But flooding can also happen, and this can backfire. What if you walk across that skywalk and you stay activated to a stress switch level of 9 or 10 the entire time, and then it takes hours for you to calm down after that? Do you think that's going to be helpful? And this is what psychologists have to watch out for. When we're desensitizing people, we don't want to create flooding. We used to try to do that and realize, okay, this just made it worse, and now our patients hate us, and they don't want to come back, right? I never did it, but in the 80s, it was pretty big. So, and then they don't come back to therapy, and then it's actually made things worse. So you need to make sure that you don't create a flooding situation. And also, it's much easier to face your fear when your fear is a 3 or a 4 than when it's a 9 or a 10. And so I applaud you for wanting to confront that, but it would be a way to make that easier using the technology, because no matter how many deep breaths you take, I guarantee you that getting on that skywalk, you're going to be a 9 or a 10, and we just want to make sure that you're really desensitizing yourself.
Yeah, great. Good advice. I'll keep that in mind. I still got a little bit of time before that. Now, what would you say to someone who feels that they cope with their stress, you know, because I've talked to people before who, you know, have been in stressful situations, and I've asked them, you know, what's going on, and well, I'm coping with it. What would you say to those who have that perspective?
It is so interesting, because probably 50% of my patients that come in, they tell me what their goal is to just cope better with their stress. Or cope better with something. And I say, well, I really don't like that as a goal, because I think we can do better. How about if you didn't have anything to cope with? Right? So coping with stress looks like this. And this is when I used to do just cognitive therapy. I had a wonderful, amazing client, very high level executive that was his job was in peril because he was afraid of flying. And so with talk therapy and methods, we got him on a plane, and then he started flying. It became easier, but every time he would get on, he'd have to do rituals. He'd have to check the weather in the morning. He'd have to work out that morning. He'd have to make sure he didn't have too much coffee. He'd have to breathe deeply in the airport. And if something happened, like there was a weather storm or there was a delay, he would still get really anxious. Now, he would get on the plane, but he was suffering. And he would get to his destination, and he would be completely exhausted, because when our stress switches on, it's exhausting us physically. Okay. That's coping. Okay. Now that's way better than not getting on the plane and getting fired. But then he came back to me a few years later when I had studied something called EMDR therapy. And I'm like, how's it going on the airplane? And he said, you know, fine. But when I delved into it, he was like, this is what I'm doing to get through it. And I'm like, look, I have a therapy that actually can desensitize your nervous system reaction to stress. And I think you'll just get on a plane and you won't have any anxiety. And he looked at me like I was crazy, but we did it. And now he just boards a plane and has zero anxiety. That's curing excess stress. So we have, when we do research, we have these outcome-based measures, and we look at, okay, well, he still got on the plane, so that's a win. And I'm like, yeah, but you got to look deeper into this process and what this poor guy's going through just to get on this plane. It's so taxing because he's coping. And if I can change this thing to where there's no coping necessary, that then we're really in business. And that's the message I want people to understand, is that coping still sucks. Coping still means that we're dealing with something that's taking our energy and that's taking our, you know, and that's distracting us again from the higher level things, joy, being present in the moment, you know, thinking about, you know, wonderful things, right? Anytime we're stressed out and coping, we are distracted from those things that bring our lives meaning and allow us to really contribute.
Yeah. That's very good. Yeah. Now, One last question, since we're kind of winding down to the end. As a mom and a business owner, entrepreneur, author, many women find managing multiple roles very stressful. So how do you kind of figure things out to be able to manage the multiple roles?
That's a really good question. I think without knowing what I know, and without having done certain things, I don't think there's any way I could pull this off. I don't think I would have written the book. I don't think I would be able to have balance. You know, I still actually have time for fun. I work out. I have, you know, I have friends. So I feel like my life is relatively at balance. Sometimes it knocks itself off kilter when I'm under a lot of time pressure because I tend to take on too much. So that's my Achilles heel.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, again, if you look at the efficiency of what you're doing, and I'm not talking about, you know, the old Franklin planner kind of stuff and everything like that, and, you know, getting an email system that you can manage better. I'm talking about staying in a low stress switch state as much as possible. That gives you so much more energy to manage everything. And I am by no means perfect with this. You know, I always joke that I have all this knowledge, but I'm not immune from the human condition, right? So I get worn out. Mm-hmm. I do get stressed. I do go into fight or flight, all these human things. But I don't really lose sleep no matter what's going on. And there's a lot of things I've done for myself and managing this, not only with touch points and the technology, but, you know, the base of healthy behaviors, wearing orange glasses at night, 7 to 9 hours of sleep every night, making it a priority, you know, starting to meditate, exercise, eating pretty healthy, you know, all those things are just my base habits and they don't require a lot of energy anymore. And then I did a course of something called neurofeedback on my brain several years ago, and that made my brain internally a lot more efficient. So I think I do a pretty good job of juggling because my kids also, their father lives overseas and I'm divorced.
Uh-huh.
So I'm actually doing this also as a single parent, but being able to really pay attention to my stress switch allows me to, I think kind of, you know, do it all, so to speak. It would be great if my life were a little less complicated. I'm not going to lie, but I think I'm doing all right.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, that's the case. You know, you obviously want to do the best you can with what you have and being empowered and having good tools to draw from are really key to helping maintain that balance.
Yeah.
Agreed. Well, Dr. Sarin, this has really been fascinating. Thank you very much for your time. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Thank you so much. And I really appreciate what you're doing to elevate the human condition. So it's been a real pleasure and honor to be with you.
Thank you very much. Again, everyone, today, my special guest has been Dr. Amy Sarin. We've been talking about her new book, The Stress Switch, The Truth About Stress and How to Short Circuit It. And again, you can find out more about her book as well as the TouchPoints wearable devices by visiting her website, which is www.amysarin.com. And that's AmySerin.com. So everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth Show. And until we meet again, thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth Show. Remember, our show is available as a free podcast from Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio. To follow our show, visit our homepage at byteradio.me and select the platform you use most. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at byteradio.me. Until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.